I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Greg Lambrecht, the founder of Coravin, a company that produces a device that allows wine enthusiasts to access wine without removing the cork. So if you want just a glass or two from a bottle, the Coravin extracts just a portion of the wine and replaces it with argon gas. Greg is also the founder of Intrinsic Therapeutics, a medical device company focused on spinal disorders. Greg is a graduate of MIT, and he has degrees in nuclear and mechanical engineering. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
How does the Coravin work?
So the Coravin is a simple handheld system about the size of a rabbit cork pull. It works by passing a thin needle, a non-coring needle that actually was originally developed for medical purposes, through the cork. Then you push a trigger. Argon gas inflates the bottle, essentially. It increases the pressure on the inside of the bottle. When you let go of the trigger, that pressure pushes the wine through the needle and out of the spout and into your glass. You pull the needle out of the cork, and the cork, because of its elasticity, reseals. The key for us, really, is that we take advantage of the cork's natural elasticity to allow it to continue doing its preservation job. Mm-hmm. We've just found out a way to get the wine out of the bottle without removing it.
Okay, so show me this. Where is the argon? Is that
the
this
capsule.
Here?
The capsule. The capsule actually goes in here.
Okay. So there's one in there now?
That's right. You can always tell by pushing the button. You hear that's the argon gas coming out.
How small is the needle?
It's a little bit over a millimeter. It's a 17-gauge needle, and it's actually a medical-grade needle.
It looks bigger than I was expecting.
Oh, yeah. You know, the cork is really the most elastic natural material, the structural material we've ever found. And really what I did was take advantage of its elasticity to be able to get a reasonably large gauge needle through it to pour wine as quickly as possible.
What is the history of the cork in wine?
It's a good question. I read about it only after I developed Coravin, but the cork is really the best tested wine preservation system that we've got. Wine's been around for about 8,000 years, as far as we know. It started in Iran or the Caucasus and spread its way, like all good things, across the planet. Cork in glass is an argument between the French and the English, as there frequently is. But the best records show that it was developed by a guy who manufactured glass bottles in England in the 1600s. And he just decided that if he used cork in glass, that he could seal wine and better preserve it. The biggest problem with wine was that it would oxidize over time. You couldn't preserve the flavors of it for very long at all, so it was drunk quite young. Once he developed that system of cork and glass, people have been enjoying wine over decades since.
What is cork made out of?
Cork is it's a biologic plant-like material, and it's got a really remarkable cellular structure where the cells encapsulate a little bit of air, but it's completely contained. They're really, really small, and there's lots of them. And that air and that structure allows it to be compressed actually upwards of 90%, and it'll recover the vast majority of its size. So it's been great for sealing things for a long time.
The traditional cork is being replaced by other closures over the last decade or so. Why is that shift happening?
Well, there was a terrible tragedy that happened. Most cork is made in Portugal and by the Amaral family, I think. It goes way, way back. It's a beautiful tradition. Portugal went through some political troubles and economic troubles in the 70s and 80s. And the Amaral family really was sort of kicked out, and the farms were taken over by people who really didn't know what they were doing. So they had bad storage practices, they had bad treatment practices that wound up producing subquality, subpar cork that wound up being shipped all over the planet, and in particular south of the equator. So the Australians, the South Americans, and even some of the Americans in the 1980s were getting really poor quality cork that either resulted in early oxidation of their wine or the transfer of this really foul chemical called TCA. And so with those failures, the French and actually then the Australians developed the screw top, which is the most broadly used alternative closure.
And do the Portuguese, are they back in action with providing cork to the global market?
They absolutely are, and they have cleaned up their act dramatically. And the incidence of things like premature oxidation and tainting, cork taint, which is TCA, has dropped dramatically. I think when somebody comes out with a competitive closure that starts taking over, you respond.
Why does Portugal have a monopoly over the cork supply?
Trees live for 100 plus years. They take a long time to develop, and they like to grow in certain areas. So Portugal is the number one, Spain and France. It's a very European product, as I think it has been for thousands of years.
If the cork has this elasticity, why has it been so challenging to create a device such as the Coravin to preserve wine in the past or up until now?
I've always felt that the most challenging thing in developing a new product is identifying the unmet need you're trying to address. I've always felt that once you've really captured the need in a unique way, the product itself sort of falls into your hands. And I think what's been the assumption throughout history since the 1600s was that in order to drink a glass of wine, you need to remove the cork. And I think the fundamental step that I took when I invented this device was saying, no, I don't actually need to remove the cork.
Did you have sort of this epiphany moment where you're like, wait, actually, let me go about this a different way?
I'd worked on my first medical product was a needle product, one for J&J and then another one for Pfizer. So I had become really good at needles over the course of a few years. And I remember literally standing in my house with a needle in my hand and a bottle of wine in my other and thinking, there's got to be a way that I can get this wine out of this bottle without pulling that cork using this needle. And I think the rest was quite easy.
And you had the coincidence of your wife being pregnant in 1999 when you came up with the idea so that you were basically alone drinking wine and you wanted to find a way to preserve the wine. Now, that's the anecdote. Is that just coincidence?
It always sounds so tragic. You're drinking alone. Yeah, it was the driver, certainly. My wife was pregnant. We always used to enjoy wine together. And actually, her taste has permanently changed as a result of her pregnancy, which is not uncommon. Mm. And there were, I think at first it was, look, I want to be able to drink a glass and not commit to the whole bottle. But then I realized, you know, what I really want and what's missing is a way that I can drink however much wine from any of my bottles at any time mm-hmm. without having any compromise in the quality of the remaining wine.
By the way, you said your wife's taste, her name is Lee, has changed since her pregnancies. How so?
There are some good things and bad things about pregnancy. It's remarkable the vast impact that it can have on a woman's body in all sorts of unpredictable ways. And the sort of benign one that happened to my wife, she became super sensitive to smells and tastes. She's very good at picking up oxidation. She's been great in part of my testing as I developed Coravin to see whether or not wines had changed. But she really has lost a taste for strong flavored things like broccoli or truffles or wine of any kind. She's still a great wine detector taster.
So even decades after having children.
Yeah.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Greg Lambrecht, co-founder of Coravin, a company that produces a device that allows people to access wine without removing the cork. This allows a person to drink one or two glasses without compromising the remaining wine in the bottle. You use argon as the gas to prevent oxidation. And argon is a noble gas. It's an element. It's inert. And the Greek word means literally lazy.
Yeah. And it is a lazy gas, I guess. It doesn't, or it's an antisocial gas. Mm. It doesn't want to play with anybody. It doesn't bond to anything. I actually experimented with a variety of different gases over the 10 years it took me from the time I came up with the idea till starting the company. I wanted to see which gas had the least impact on wine over time. For me, the ultimate was if a professional couldn't tell the difference between a wine that had been accessed, I'd poured a couple of glasses out of the bottle years ago, maybe a decade ago, mm-hmm. and one that had been untouched.
Yeah.
So argon very quickly rose to the top along with a few other gases, and I really wasn't able to tell the difference, as has been demonstrated by a lot of people that have tried.
Now, argon is heavier than oxygen, so it forms a blanket over the wine. Is that right?
That's right. It's about 1% of the air we breathe, but it is heavier than air. And that gives it some really tremendous advantages, both for the Coravin, and actually it's a commonly used gas in the wine industry during the bottling process.
I've heard the Coravin described as a mosquito, and for people who want to picture how the Coravin works, Just as a mosquito extracts blood using a needle, so too does the corvin extract wine. You had mosquito in the initial name, correct?
That three-year-old older son of mine gave it a very sticky name, literally from the start, wine mosquito. We dropped it because mosquitoes have also been responsible for malaria and, you know, millions of dead. So we've dropped it from our lexicon. But it was the name of the product between 2000 and 2011, when it was really just my device at home.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Greg Lambrecht, co-founder of Corvin, a company that produces a device that allows people to access wine without removing the cork. This allows a person to drink one or two glasses without compromising the remaining wine in the bottle. You started Corvin from a personal need. Had you always been interested in wine?
I grew up in Southern California, probably had my first wine at a reasonably illegal age. So there's a wine culture in California, and I'd always liked it and been interested. I was introduced to one of the first most shocking wines that I'd had. It was an Hermitage from France, a red wine, and it didn't taste anything like a grape. It tasted like pepper and meat and all these strange things. And I thought, you know, how did this happen? And I think that's one of the pleasures of wine, is the exploration of how a single grape in different regions made by different people can in one place taste like blueberries and strawberries in Australia, taste like red meat in France, and be a spectacular drink in California with totally different characteristics.
And while you were a wine enthusiast, you are and were primarily a medical device inventor. At what point did you say, you know what, I'm going to take this invention of mine seriously?
I'd been making them for my own use for a while, and then one of my friends saw it, who's now one of my co-founders, and said, you know, can I have one of those? So I made him one. Then I had a very good friend, one of my investors in Intrinsic. He got married, and as a wedding gift, I made him one. Mm. And then people that they knew saw it and started asking for it. So I started making, I don't know, a dozen a month. And realized, hey, wait a minute, it's not just me who has this problem. There's a lot of people who have the same interest to try a variety of different wines and not have to commit to any of the bottles.
And this invention was marinating for, you know, over a decade. You first thought of the idea in 1999,
yep.
But it wasn't until 2003 that you developed your first prototype. And by the way, 23, 24 prototypes later, we now have a Corvin.
You know, I'm a perfectionist. It helps you in medicine because you never want to have a failure if you can help it. I am a scientist at heart. I want to make sure that it worked perfectly. And it was a side hobby, but it got to a point where I realized, you know, I've touched on something that people are passionate about, which is what really gets me going.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Greg Lambrecht, founder of Corvin. We'll hear more from Greg coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Greg Lambrecht, the founder of Corvin, a company that produces a device that allows wine enthusiasts to access wine without removing the cork. So if you want just a glass or two from a bottle, the Corvin extracts just a portion of the wine and replaces it with argon gas. Greg is also the founder of Intrinsic Therapeutics, a medical device company focused on spinal disorders. Greg is a graduate of MIT, and he has degrees in nuclear and mechanical engineering. When you say that you gave the Corvin as gifts, I mean, this, I'm looking at it, it's intricate. It's made of metal, and it's really solid. I mean, is it made in China?
So great. I think you look at something, and it looks beautiful. Now, this is how much the world has changed. You think it must be made in China or Germany. So it's a sad truth, but actually not a sad truth. They're both great places. I have a machine shop in my basement. I'm an inventor, and so I like to relax by making things. So I have been machining since I was in college. It's just something that's very peaceful for me, designing and machining. So I made them all in my basement.
Using what? I mean, it's made of metal.
Yeah. So I would cut it, design it, and cut it by hand. I probably would have been a watchmaker a century ago. I just love precision machining. Now I had the enormously good fortune of running into and being introduced to our current CEO, when I was looking for a board member, Nick Lazaris, who really took Keurig, the single-serve coffee-making company, from pre-revenue to its sale to Green Mountain and then the billions that it added to their valuation. Really spectacular guy.
This is a coffee-making machine, by
the way. Yeah, the Keurig single-serve coffee maker. Nick had relationships with a spectacular manufacturing partner in Hong Kong and China. Without them, Coravin would not have gotten to market.
Another key ally or person for you in this endeavor is Robert Parker, the wine critic. He basically has given it a wet kiss, which he never does. The last time he did it was with Riedel glasses, I believe.
Yeah, Riedel from Austria. I had the really good fortune of being introduced to him by one of our investors. Robert Parker is just what he appears. He is completely unbiased by industry and by me. And actually, he was, when I was invited to see him by this friend, I remember sitting down to dinner and he looked at me and he said, "I just wanted to let you know, I don't like gadgets. I don't think they work. I really don't understand what it is you're doing, but there's no way that this could possibly work." So I brought in a couple of bottles that I had been drinking, actually that had been rated well by him. He is the one that I followed for a while to try to, and still do, to really explore the wines of Hermitage and all these things that I loved. So I poured him a glass of wine from a bottle that I'd accessed probably 6-8 years ago. And as soon as he tasted it, he looked at me and said, "You know, this is the biggest change I've seen in wine in the last 34 years. I think I had a permagrin for about, I still do." He's a spectacular guy.
A permagrin. I like that. So was he just trying to be cheeky, you know, when he said, "Just want you to know I don't like devices," or was he actually being, you know, factual when he sat down with you?
He's a direct guy. And I think you need to be when you are in the wine rating world. It's a pretty hard-nosed world.
You were introduced to Robert Parker by your friend Jerry Facciani.
Yep.
How did you meet Jerry Facciani?
Jerry came to an investor meeting. I was trying to raise money, actually, for Coravin, our first big round here in New York. Jerry shows up at this meeting, and he starts helping me to set up for my sales pitch to this investment fund. And I'm thinking, who is this guy? Since then, and many people have told me the same thing, you meet Jerry Facciani and you fall in love with him right away.
So he's just a stranger who came up to you at a conference and he liked the product and he just wanted to be helpful?
Exactly. And he was close to Robert Parker and made the introduction by email and then was there when we went to dinner saying, "You know, Bob, you really need to see this."
We talk about key opinion leaders, and Robert Parker is that for you. Can you talk to me a little bit more about key opinion leaders in the medical device world?
Absolutely. The medical device world is very complex. There are regulatory, there's not only the human body and its pathology and the thing you're trying to solve and the variability from person to person, but there's also the regulatory world. Then there's reimbursement. More and more reimbursement is the number one challenge that a med tech company faces. The people that many of the government regulatory agencies and payers turn to are physicians that are the heads of their societies or have written extensively on a topic that you're working on. And it's exceedingly important to go see those folks very early on in the process, perhaps involve them in your clinical trials, so that they are aware of you. They know why you are trying to solve the problem, what problem you're solving, what you're good for, what you're not good for, so that when the agencies and the payers call them, they are informed. And if you don't, there can be a hostility. Why didn't you come see me? You know, why did you ignore me? So in having the experience of making mistakes in the medtech world, I brought that same philosophy of going to the key opinion leaders in the wine world first, before we launched. And that was the top sommeliers in New York and San Francisco, the top wine producers in California, the top wine raters, both here in the United States, Wine Spectator, Robert Parker. Also over in Europe, Jancis Robinson, had the tremendous pleasure of meeting her. These are all really good people that have worked their way into positions of authority and trust.
So you benefited by getting the attention of these people early on, even before the ultimate development of whether it's a medical device product or the Coravin.
Yeah, I would do it in every company that I start.
It's striking to me that in the medical device world that they need to feel like they were in on it early.
I wish the medical device world were more objective. There are complex political issues associated with medtech, as you can see even now. So despite, there are some companies that are successful despite bad clinical results, and there are some companies that are very successful or very unsuccessful despite excellent clinical results. And the difference between them is really, to some extent, partially involved with the luck and relationships that are developed early on.
In addition to Robert Parker being a key person for you in making the public aware of this, you mentioned some sommeliers in New York City were key. First was Mario Batali's restaurant, Del Posto, and now 11 Madison Park uses it. How important was that?
It was really, really important. And actually, we're replicating the same thing that we did in the U.S. in France and in Germany and in England right now. We would bring together a group of sommeliers at a dinner, access a half a case of a wine. So we'd take half of it, and we'd access it, pour it, explain the system to them, wait 6 months, invite them back to another tasting, have them taste blind to see if they could tell the difference between access and unaccess. This is 6 months out, some of them 9 months out. Number one, it was validation that we functioned, that it worked. That was really important. And number two, these people are deeply connected in the restaurant scene, in the press.
Was there any other key person or pivot point for you that's helped to get the word out?
Retail wine stores have been enormously important for our success. And they're great. They demonstrate the product. They can pour people wines before they buy. They can help them to explore regions of wine, to teach them, you know, what is an oxidized Italian wine and this type of thing that you would never have experienced before.
Now, I have to admit, my husband is a fan. But when I first heard of this, I thought, really, do you really need to spend $300 on this device? Like, does one really need that?
Yeah. You have to tell me. What's your conclusion? I'll try to bias you in advance. I think it's what Coravin is not a preservation system. Really, the advantage that Coravin provides, it's a new category. It's wine access. You can drink from any bottle you have at any time. You can serve any bottle you want in a restaurant or at home. You can pair wines. You can learn 6-10 times as fast about wine. And part of the pleasure of wine is its variety and and your understanding. You go into the average wine guy's home with a Coravin or woman's home with a Coravin, and on their counter, they'll have 6 bottles of wine. And they're drinking across those bottles over the course of a week, trying to learn something.
So if you reframe the picture from wine preservation to wine access, then it really changes the experience of wine drinking.
I think so. It changes. People have written me long letters where they say, look, you've changed my life. I had this cellar of wine that I wasn't drinking because I didn't know whether or not it was ready. And then all of a sudden, I start to access this wine, and I'm tasting more, sampling more, learning more, understanding more, leaving the cork behind to do its preservation job is a really important thing.
How did you get the name Coravin?
Coravin was a knockdown, drag-out naming fight that took us months. Cor is the Latin root for heart, and vin from France, wine. So the heart of wine was what we thought, and brings in a little bit of my medical background. And my love of wine.
Your co-founder is Josh Schmackauer, a medical doctor. He's on the board of Intrinsic, your medical device company.
Josh Schmackauer is one of the most extraordinary medical innovators on the planet and an open-minded, optimistic guy who believes that absolutely everything can change.
What's an example of some of the devices he's invented?
Oh, he developed probably dozens. I think he has 6 or 7 companies running at a time, and one of them was Acclarent. Acclarent is an enormously successful company that solved one of the biggest problems in sinus surgery. People that have chronic sinusitis from a clogged nasal sinus. Mm-hmm. He developed this way that you can push a balloon up in there, inflate it, open up the sinus, pull it out, and you walk out of the doctor's office feeling better.
I love the transfer of technology in general from one industry to a very disparate other industry.
I think that it's always good to have the most open-minded and innocent people involved in the understanding of the problem and the creation of the first new idea. Mm-hmm. Frequently, the best ideas come from people who are outside of the industry because they're not biased.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Greg Lambrecht, co-founder of Coravin, a company that produces a device that allows people to access wine without removing the cork. This allows a person to drink 1 or 2 glasses without compromising the remaining wine in the bottle. I want to switch gears a little bit. I want to talk about your medical device profession. You've founded 2 companies. One is called Viacor, which allows subcutaneous cardiac valve replacement. And that company, the intellectual property connected to it, was sold to Medtronic in the 90s?
Or? Yeah, it was an actually, it's a company of success and failure. It was my first medtech company. My mother has a leaky mitral valve. I tend to work on the problems of my family. And aortic valves, an aortic valve failure is a very quick cause of death. Viacor tried to fix the mitral valve through a small stick in an artery in your leg and a vein in your neck. And this, instead of having a cracked chest, open heart procedure to fix your mitral valve, we thought we could fix it percutaneously while you're awake. Unfortunately, we had some issues with luck. We had some issues with financing and management. So the company ultimately wasn't successful.
But the IP, the intellectual property, was sold to Medtronic.
It was indeed.
And are they using that process now?
You know, you find out whether or not they're using it when they contact you for patent extensions. So I'm constantly seeing new patents with my name on them from Medtronic. So it makes me happy that they're using it.
How many patents do you have?
Ooh,
have you had?
I've lost count. Over 100.
Now, you mentioned Viacor just had ill luck. What's an example of that? Aside from management, which was subpar.
Raising money is a key skill of a CEO, and our CEO really wasn't terribly skilled at it, but a great, great guy. We had the misfortune of having an adverse event right when we were raising money. Mm. And despite the fact that we may have been better than any other procedure that's out there currently, bad timing can get you.
Mm. So you had tried the procedure and it didn't work?
In one patient, yeah.
A more recent company that you founded is Intrinsic Therapeutics. It's a medical device company focused on spinal disorders. Here, it's connected to a personal experience of your mother who had sciatica. Can you explain what it does and how your mom benefited from it?
It sounds like I only work on products with my mother. The most common problem in spine is a herniated disc. Herniated discs compress a nerve that goes down your leg and you feel this shooting pain. You get loss of function in the leg, loss of the ability to lift your toe off the ground, for example. The fundamental problem is that the disc is ruptured. It's like a tire, and the stuff on the inside of the tire comes out and compresses the nerves. We're a very intricate tire patch.
You've always had an interest in making things and fixing things. Did you, as a child, what are some memories as a child just being very hands-on and producing things?
I never really tolerated things that didn't work. I was also very positively influenced by my grandfather, who was a weapons designer during the last century. He sort of ignited my interest in making stuff, and the two of us would tear apart a bicycle and then rebuild it together. He was really my inspiration.
There's a story about him advising you not to make weapons, but to make things that were more positive. Can you describe that further?
Yeah. My grandfather was an Austrian. He wound up developing one of the first jet engines and then missile guidance systems for Germany during World War II. He was captured by the Americans in 1944 and was lucky to have been so, as he always told me. Wound up working on missile systems here in the United States, along with many other German scientists. And he came up to me, I think it was 1981, I was 11 years old, and he said, "We've made enough weapons. You should do something else. Medicine or power? We'll never have enough of either."
By the way, he was Austrian, so he was on the enemy's side of history.
Yeah.
How have you reconciled that?
Yeah, it's I was not involved, obviously, in what went on. And it was a terrible, terrible tragedy. And the Germans did some horrible things, as they know and as we know. I think ultimately what you try to do is take the best of it. And if I can work in medicine and make people's lives better, if I can work in wine, something that people are really passionate about. I had a surgeon tell me, "I understand your career. You make stuff to make to fix us so that we can live longer to enjoy the wine that we really like." And I took that to heart. And so I think part of the influence of the negativity of World War II was to try to take my grandfather's experience in really destroying things and turn it into something positive.
And this is a man you love, obviously. But, you know, have you dealt with that complication?
Yeah. And, you know, I think people in World War II walked away from that experience being on the wrong side. One of two ways, either with, or maybe a combination, terrible guilt or denial. And when I talked to my grandfather about it, I remember I didn't have long with him. He felt both. every country has its epic disastrous behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, we had the slave history. We just need to recover, move on. Luckily, the younger generation seem much better informed.
Now, you mentioned you lived in California, but you lived in New York City in the Village up until you were 11. Do you have any memories or that feature in your past about what you're doing now, if anything?
Yeah, I think that the difference, if you were to contrast two places in the U.S., you could pick Newport Beach, California, and Manhattan, radically different. So, you know, New York kids go to the museum, right? They're interested in art and music. They don't get a whole lot of time on grass. It's a very intellectual world.
And was that for you?
It was, and I love that about New York. And then California is about the beach. It's about cars. It's about how you look and where you live. And actually, that was very informative as well. I became a big surfer. I loved it out there.
And in a way, this contraption is a fusion of those both.
It is, and art and design have to meet up with purpose and functionality. I personally think that Corvin's a beautiful system.
And revelry.
Yeah, and joy, that's true. And there are joys on both coasts. I think they come from different places, but they're on both coasts.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
It was really my pleasure.
My guest has been Greg Lambrecht, founder of Corvin. Coming up, we'll meet Michael Brown, co-founder of CityYear. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Michael Brown, co-founder of CityYear, an organization focused on addressing the national dropout crisis, where 1 million American students drop out of high school every year. CityYear's almost 3,000 core members serve as tutors, mentors, and role models in America's most challenging public schools. Prior to starting CityYear in 1988, Michael clerked for then-judge, now-justice Stephen Breyer. Welcome.
Thanks, Jessica. It's great to be here.
Could you tell me the experience of a CityYear core member?
So a CityYear core member is on average around 22 years old, gets up probably at the crack of dawn, some cases 5:30 in the morning, often before the sun, and they head into the urban communities around the country, and they go into some of the highest need schools, and as a team, they stand outside of the schoolhouse steps, and they clap and cheer for every student as they walk into the building, giving them high fives. And then they go into the school and they serve all day as tutors, mentors, and role models, helping kids who are probably, many of them, destined not to graduate, to graduate, by helping them get back on track.
Now, I've read somewhere that there are about 13,500 high schools in the United States, and 12% of them yield 50% of the dropouts. Is CityYear focusing on those specific high schools in that 12%?
Exactly. Yes, this is a breakthrough study that Johns Hopkins University put together, and it did find that about 1 million students drop out in America. The study further found that you can identify who's likely to drop out by these early warning indicators, high absences, poor behaviors, or getting an F in math or English. So what we do is we go into the high schools that have the worst dropout records, as well as the elementary and middle schools that feed into them. Mm. So we're in these students' lives in a multi-year continuum of care from grades 3 through 9.
Can you provide a concrete example or two of the experience of one of the children being impacted?
Yeah, so this is a student who even the teachers had said, no one's been able to get through to this student. She's incredibly disruptive. It turns out that the core member found out that this student's mother was being deported. Now, if you can imagine trying to come to school every single day and being said, these are your lessons, these are the things you're supposed to do, this is the way you're supposed to deport yourself, all these other things. But no one had yet learned what was really happening in her life, that her mother's being deported. And she had put up all these walls around her. Mm-hmm. But the core member has that time. and that capability to be there. And as the student pushes her away, she just keeps saying, I'm still here for you. Mm-hmm. And eventually what happens time and again is the student realizes you're not going to go away. You really are here for me. And she opened up to that student, and that student succeeded and blossomed.
City Year now looks a lot different from the City Year that you started in 1988. Can you describe what your initial intention was?
So initially, we decided we really wanted to show that national service could really help all nonprofit initiative. Whatever it is that you were doing in your nonprofit, you could do more of it if you had dedicated young people to help and join you. Mm-hmm. So we basically offered these idealistic young people to all the nonprofits in the community.
Ranging from
building community gardens, say in the morning, to helping senior citizens in the afternoon, to running after-school programs. Really the full range of nonprofit initiatives, doing the food banks. And then the exciting thing is that AmeriCorps got started, and there were many organizations that were now developing. We certainly no longer needed to be doing all different kinds of work. And we found that our unique asset of these idealistic young people could have its highest use if we put them into the highest need schools.
You have a powerful partnership network at City Year, ranging from Timberland to IBM and JetBlue. Timberland, for example, supplied all the boots for your initial core members and now
That's
continue
right.
to supply the shoes. It just seems like you've had a charmed life a little bit since inception with these partnerships. Is that the case?
So when we started City Year, we sat down on this new computer. It was called a Macintosh computer. We fancied ourselves as social entrepreneurs, and we were inspired by, you know, at the time, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak were starting a computer business out of their garage. And we said, what if we sat at my parents' dining room table in Belmont, Massachusetts, and hammered out this idea? And we had this document that said, please support this program called City Year. Would you give us our first grant? And we went around. We get meetings with companies and philanthropic leaders. And the interesting thing is, in the beginning, almost nobody said no, but nobody said yes. They would all ask, who's already supporting you? And so what we ended up doing, we sent out applications to say, be part of our pilot program for City Year, frankly, even before we had all the money. So what we ended up doing is we got these wonderful applications, and we asked questions on what are the three biggest problems facing society? Why do you want to serve? We were offering at the time $60 a week. So what we ended up doing is we photocopied the applications. We brought them into meetings. And after we talked about what we were doing, we said, well, you just spend a couple minutes reading these. Mm-hmm. And literally, the idealism of the young people would jump off the page. And I'm convinced that's why we got our first resources. The very first company to do that was then called Bank of Boston. Now it's Bank of America. Bain & Company, the consulting firm, was also there on day one. We have Comcast, CSX, the freight train company, Microsoft, Cisco.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Michael Brown, co-founder of City Year, an organization focused on improving the graduation rate in struggling public schools. City Year provides targeted intervention by focusing on improving attendance, tutoring, mentoring, and running after school programs. I want to talk about your personal history. You have had a commitment to service seemingly since very early on. Even in college, you took a year off and worked for Representative Leon Panetta, the Democrat from California. How did that happen?
Well, the very first day I got to college, I went to Harvard University, and the president of the university was then Derek Bok. He welcomed all the freshmen together in the same room, and he said, I want to welcome you to Harvard and ask you to please go away. That was his opening line. And what he meant by that was, you don't have to just go through 4 years. You can go and do something different, come back with a different perspective, perhaps with a passion. And I did that. I spent a year working on Capitol Hill after my sophomore year for then Representative Leon Panetta. And Leon had legislation about an idea I had never heard of called voluntary national service. So he introduced me to this concept. And his legislation would have created a commission to go around the country and study the idea and come back to Congress with legislation for perhaps a big program one day.
What did your parents do?
My father was a real estate attorney in Boston for 50 years. My mom was at home raising us.
You're one of five?
I'm one of five. I often say that I got my values from my parents. It was a Jewish home. My father used to love Bible stories, and you know, we used to talk about things. I mean, one of the times I remember, he said, "It says in the Talmud that if you're walking through the desert and there's two people and there's only enough water for one, and that one person has it, is there an obligation to share it? And I'm like, Dad, I'm only 5 years old. But we used to have conversations like that. I realized that it matters what you talk to your children about. And my mom kept a home of Jewish ritual. And so somewhere between the rituals and these other kinds of things, I think that had a big impact on me. At the same time, I grew up at a time when we were racing for the moon. There was always something happening, something big. And then when you add the 1960s to it, and all of the idealism of the 60s, I think when you combine all that, by the time I had heard about this idea of national service, it sort of was the institutionalization of the idealism that I felt inside of me, that I felt could be brought out of every young person if we simply called on them institutionally to give a year of service.
Your co-founder, Alan Casey, whom you went to college with and you were roommates with, you know, starting freshman year, what was his inclination towards service? He worked for Gary Hart during the presidential campaign in 1984.
So Alan Casey and I were literally assigned to be roommates together first day of freshman year at Harvard. And City Aurelia, we can thank the Harvard freshman dean's office, which was responsible for putting roommates together. Mm-hmm. And anyone that knew Alan in high school before I even met him, and anyone that's met him since, knows that he's an extraordinarily idealistic person. And so I was immediately attracted to that idealism. And we started conversations freshman year, like a lot of people have in their dorm room. And as we began to talk about it, we talked about this idea of national service.
You had a meeting with President Clinton, who at the time was a candidate for president in 1992. And you gave him the seed of the idea for AmeriCorps. Can you describe that encounter? How did it happen?
So it was it was December of 1991 during the presidential selection process of 92. It was just a couple months before the New Hampshire primary. So Governor Bill Clinton and other Democratic candidates were hanging around New Hampshire and Massachusetts. And we got a call and said, he's been asked about national service. You have this program. Can he come and visit you? So he came and he spent the better part of a couple hours. At the end of that conversation, one of the young people in our program literally took the sweatshirt off his back that said Sittier on it and gave it to him and said, Governor, please don't forget us. And that was in December of 1991. Now, fast forward to November of 1992, 11 months later, we certainly hadn't seen Bill Clinton. But in the meantime, he'd been elected president of the United States, and he was now president-elect. And it was the day after Thanksgiving, so he's 3 weeks into being president-elect. CNN is covering his every move. He's out there jogging. And guess what? He's jogging in the Sittier sweatshirt that Stephen, our core member, had given to him 11 months before. Well, I'm at home, and I'm reaching for the phone to call Alan Casey, my partner in all this. The phone's ringing. Well, I'm reaching for it, and I know it's Alan. I say, you watching this? Mm-hmm. He said, yeah, yeah. We all said, this changes everything. Because President Clinton stopped, and he was asked, President-elect Clinton, what will be your priorities as president? And he said, the national debt, healthcare, the economy. Still sound familiar. And he said, and national service will be my fourth priority. And he's wearing the Sittier sweatshirt. Mm. And we realized that he was very serious about starting this. And we worked with his administration on this AmeriCorps concept. And we realized that the power of the presidency to put these ideas forward is incredible. Today, AmeriCorps is the federal investment in national service. It funds many programs. And we're one of those programs that is sponsored by it. We're very grateful to Bill Clinton for getting it started and for supporting us all these years.
In 2003, you helped to form the Save AmeriCorps Coalition, where you spent more than 100 hours testifying in front of Congress because they were about to cut funding of AmeriCorps in half. Can you talk about that experience?
Sure. So it was almost a perfect storm of things. One thing that had happened after September 11th is so many people wanted to do AmeriCorps that there were so many grants out there and people serving that they had to actually pull the grants back from the next year. So we don't have enough. So what we did is we got together with other organizations that had utilized AmeriCorps funds, and we all came together and we formed the Save AmeriCorps Coalition. And within about 100 days, we had 44 governors that had signed a letter for emergency funding, 83 senators. And we held essentially a round-the-clock citizens hearing on Capitol Hill. They gave us rooms, and we had people come in from all the country. And it was literally for 100 hours. It was four straight days, including at 2 and 3 in the morning. young people who had served, organizations that had benefited, parents of these young people, they testified. I think it made a huge difference. Mm. We got a lot of the funding back that year, and the next year, we got the highest funding ever.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Michael Brown, co-founder of City Year, an organization focused on improving the graduation rate in struggling public schools. You have affiliates in Johannesburg and London. How did that come to be?
So the one in Johannesburg, we had an opportunity to meet with President Clinton right after he left office. And we said to him that we wanted to start an international fellowship in his name called the Clinton Democracy Fellowship to invite people from all over the world to see what U.S. programs were doing and to learn from what service programs are happening around the world. It would go in both directions. And we were going to go try to raise money for it and get it started. And he said, great, let's go do that together. And then 2 months later, we got a phone call. He had called the chair of our board, Eli Siegel at the time, who had worked with him to build AmeriCorps. And he said, I just got a call from Nelson Mandela. He wants me to speak in South Africa about how to build civil society. And he said, I want to bring those Cityer folks and show them about Cityer and AmeriCorps, about how they could engage young people in service. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, from that one meeting, within 2 months, we were on an airplane with Bill Clinton, and we went to South Africa for an extraordinary experience with him and Nelson Mandela. And we were there to share our experience and to learn from theirs. But from that, people in South Africa said, would you start a Cityer program? And if you could have told me back when we were all struggling with apartheid, back when I was in college and all, it was our number one issue, that we'd be able to work in a free just South Africa with Nelson Mandela having gone from prisoner to president. Mm. Of course we were going to say yes to all of that, even though it was 10,000 miles away. If you don't talk to them by 10 in the morning, it's too late. But it was a labor of love to build City or South Africa.
Going back to the beginning, I've read somewhere when you were starting City Year, you said it was a little bit like running off to join the circus. Why did you say that?
Well, here I had gone to these amazing institutions, and I loved the law, and I easily could have gone down that path. I was on the law review. I really thought I could see that path, but I had this sort of other pull. And yet everybody would understand, it's easy to sort of explain to your grandmother that you'd go from Harvard Law School into a top firm, and I had these wonderful offers as well. So the idea of saying no to all that, and I'm going to go just no job, no money, and just simply bang away at this new Macintosh computer and try to fund this national service program, no one really talked then about social entrepreneurship. So it was a little bit of explaining to people that there was even a career path in going off and doing something like that.
But luckily you had a safety net under the tightrope walking life that you were about to pursue, because you could always go back to clerk for Judge Breyer.
So. No, exactly. It was just that I was doing something that just seemed so different from all of that experience.
What do you remember most distinctly about working with Justice Stephen Breyer?
I had an extraordinary experience working with Justice Breyer. He's brilliant. You know, most judges I found at the time, you know, their clerks would sort of help to write the opinions. And, you know, we would do that. We would give him our drafts of things, and then he would say, thank you very much. And he would take the citations, but he would rewrite everything because he could cut through anything. And he would love to come back and talk to us as clerks about these ideas of the law. When I said I wanted to start Cityer, he was incredibly supportive. And he's come out to do everything I've ever asked of him. And my favorite one was when he came and he swore in our core, because we have a pledge that we take. And he said beautifully, he said, my job is to write about the Constitution. He said to these young people, but you're living it and making it come alive. Mm-hmm. And it speaks volumes about what kind of person he is.
You live in Boston, and your wife is a pediatrician. She treats HIV patients.
That's right.
And you have three children. Do you teach them the Talmud, and do you raise them in a Jewish home?
So we're a mixed religious family, mm-hmm. And we raise them both with Jewish and Catholic values. As you mentioned, my wife is a pediatrician, and she's my hero. She treats children with AIDS. She's kept children alive into their adulthood.
What's her name?
Charlotte, Dr. Charlotte Mao.
How did you meet Charlotte?
We met at college. We were both at Courier House at Harvard College, and we spent a summer tutoring for the Harvard Summer School and fell in love.
Were you married when you started City Year?
I got married in 1991, so 3 years into City Year, and she's my rock. And at home we have a saying, "Mom's always right," and she is. She has the most extraordinary judgment and character, and in that sense, she's been an incredible backbone for City Year.
Do you ever have anything negative to say?
Oh, I don't know. I suppose I can get frustrated like anybody else, but I do. I'm surrounded every day in what I would call a culture of idealism, which is not naivete. And at City Year, we talk about snuffing out cynicism because it's just the enemy of positive good. So I take idealism seriously and as an art and a practice.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Jessica. It's my pleasure.
My guest has been Michael Brown, co-founder of City Year. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.